This is the Agribusiness Report. I'm Tony St. James. Well, our special guest today is Ethan Lane. Ethan's with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, joins us in just a moment. First off, Jay Johnson, Livestock Behavior Research Unit, talks about some of the impacts of heat stress on hogs and what producers can do.
In these summer months, we're particularly concerned about heat stress in our herds. Not only does it have a direct negative impact on our pigs' productivity, some of their welfare and health outcomes, we see losses in pregnancies for some of our pregnant sows, but we also see some downstream negative impacts on offspring that are gestated under heat stress conditions. And so that really inspired us to take on this challenge of how do we actually define heat stress in our pigs, particularly those with more modern genetics. There is a need in the pig industry to develop some better decision support tools for producers to determine when or when not to implement cooling strategies on farm.
This is the Agribusiness Report. I'm Tony St. James. We're joined today by Ethan Lane. Ethan is with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Ethan, great to see you.
Great to be back with you.
Okay, let's talk about all things DC right now, because just about the time you say, I've never seen this before, somebody, I guess we'll use the old cliche, hold my beer.
Right.
We've had a few of those, haven't we?
We have, and you know, it's always funny when everyone says, you know, this is unprecedented in Washington, but if you go back far enough, there's always precedent for the kind of battles that we are seeing right now, the kind of narrow majority kind of cliffhangers that seem to be kind of the hallmark of the 118th Congress thus far. Obviously, we knew coming into this Congress that the debt ceiling was going to be a big issue. We saw that during Kevin McCarthy's protracted speaker vote at the beginning of this Congress. We knew the Freedom Caucus was going to kind of hold that up as one of their sort of major linchpins, and certainly that was the case. But you know, he navigated those waters, I think, pretty effectively. Got a deal that I think for a lot of conservatives included some big wins that were unexpected. You know, codifying some of the gains that we made on the National Environmental Policy Act under the Trump administration, getting those baked into statute. That's no small matter. Moving the needle on some of those work requirements for SNAP recipients that, you know, just 2 months ago were absolutely DOA, according to a lot of Democrats on Capitol Hill. That's some pretty significant movement, you know, in the grand scheme of things. But nevertheless, you know, that marker that had kind of been put out there at the beginning of this Congress that the Freedom Caucus didn't want to see him make a deal or ever do anything that Democrats would want to vote for, you know, obviously was on full display. He got a majority of the majority, but he had to get more Democrats than Republicans to get across the finish line on that bill. And that is something that you're going to see, I think, the Freedom Caucus continue to hound him over in the coming weeks and months. But, excuse me. Nevertheless, a pretty significant legislative accomplishment, given the dynamics, given the personalities at play. Certainly, I think, got more in that negotiation than anyone gave him credit for being able to get. And that's a serious accomplishment in this kind of environment.
Well, and I think something that's interesting to point out here, that Freedom Caucus is really focused on the debt and spending. How will that work into ag appropriations?
Well, we're already seeing that in the bill that's left the ag appropriations subcommittee that we're expecting to see a markup on here shortly in the full appropriations committee. That bill has a pretty substantial haircut for USDA. I think 30% across the board for USDA. That's a major decline in spending there. Now, obviously, that's offset with some of the IRA money and you know, things like that we've seen for conservation programs going into the farm bill. You know, they're looking at all these different priorities and kind of trying to balance what money gets spent where. So there's always a little more to the, you know, to the numbers than meets the eye. But to be sure, we're seeing bills come out of the House that are curtailing spending substantially, and that's going to play into that overall package, you know, going through the summer. I think it's interesting to see how quickly they're moving through that process. You know, we've seen some spending processes in the last few years that have either been been late or, quite frankly, have never really gotten off the ground. You know, you get into the fall and you're expecting some kind of an omnibus, but they don't have the detail to work with. Instead, here we are in mid-June, we're seeing bills move through the House, which ostensibly means that'll give the Senate something to work on in the latter half of this summer. That's the way this process should work. But there's a lot of work left to be done, obviously, and you know, we'll see what the Senate does with those bills once they get them on their side. But progress is being made, and that's a positive thing. Whether or not it's enough for the Freedom Caucus as far as cuts and curtailing that federal spending remains to be seen. I get the sense that they're more concerned right now with whether or not there are Democrats in support than they are with a lot of the substance of those bills. And that's not a knock. That's just an observation. That seems to be kind of where their focus is right now. If Democrats support any part of it, then there must be something wrong with it. And, you know, that kind of seems to be part of the political calculus.
So farm bill debate, I've heard it said from a couple of members now, this has got to cross the finish line this year before we roll into next year. We'll definitely have less money next year if we have to wait. Are you watching that same ball, if you will?
Oh, I think so. But the vote balance doesn't change next year versus this year. And certainly next year is going to be the heat of a presidential election. But the same fiscal conservative, I think, thoughts are going to be in control up on Capitol Hill. You know, even with a Democratic narrow majority in the Senate, you still have those, you know, those kind of hawks on the Democratic side. Joe Manchin, obviously, is going to feature into that conversation. You know, you have Kyrsten Sinema in Arizona that's found a lot of opportunities to cross the aisle. Certainly, I think there are other moderate Democrats who look at the political capital that some of their brethren have generated by stepping away from the conference on this issue or that, and looking at the utility of doing that on their own in some instances. So I think all that plays into that conversation, whether it's this year, whether it's before September 30th, whether it's in the lame duck, or whether we're having this conversation next year. You know, I think what we keep looking at is those vote totals. You know, you only have so many votes to play with in the House. Obviously, with Chris Stewart stepping away in Utah, until that seat is filled, that's going to create yet another, you know, vote that there isn't any flexibility with. We're watching the George Santos situation in New York, obviously. At a certain point, he may no longer be casting votes in New York. That one is far more questionable, whether you'd be able to refill that seat with a Republican that's going to vote the same way as the Speaker would like on some of these issues. I still think that it's a tough proposition to get to the finish line in September on this bill. That is despite, I think, really Herculean efforts, both by the Ag Committee leadership on both sides of the Hill, but also House Republican leadership. I think they've taken this process really seriously. I think they've engaged stakeholders early. I think they've stressed how important this bill is and that they want to get it across the finish line. But, you know, all politics are local, and a lot of times those members are looking at their folks back home and what they think they want to see out of this or don't want to see, more so than, gosh, this is what's good for the congressional calendar here in Washington. So I still think there's a good chance we're going to be talking about this bill next year. But certainly in the meantime, you know, we all want to educate and help members understand why it's important to get this process moving.
I hope you don't mind me asking one more. You talk about what's happening back home, but the importance of trade to the industry. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely vital, especially to the cattle industry. Is that something you're watching as well?
Absolutely. You know, that's been a bright spot for us in the last couple of years. $11 billion in exports for the beef industry last year is nothing to sneeze at. That's a big number. And you know, that's a lot of value on every fed carcass going through the system. You know, we have a lot more work to do in that space. Trade has not been a terribly popular subject, even amongst Republicans up on Capitol Hill in the last couple of years. That fever seems to be breaking a little bit. There seems to be a renewed understanding of why trade is important, why exports are important. You know, a lot of commodities, I think, are going up to the Hill and talking about the fact that they want to see some expanded markets. It actually probably doesn't hurt that the president and his administration have been a little bit behind the curve in moving the needle on trade. You know, that's allowing some space for Republicans, I think, to recapture that issue and talk about why it's important. But certainly, we're hearing some conversations in a way we haven't in the past couple of years, you know, talking about the need need to start moving the needle on exports and expanding markets, that's great news for us. We want to continue to foster that conversation. That's a winning issue for our producers around the country. We produce the highest quality beef in the world. We do it with the lowest environmental footprint in the world. Every market we go into, the consumers there want more of what we produce, whether it's South Korea, whether it's Japan, you name it. We produce a really popular product. So the more we can get that out there in front of people, the better off we are. And that's a conversation we want to make sure we're continuing to have up on Capitol Hill.
Ethan, it's always great to see you. Thanks for the time and the information and the work you do. We wish you the best through the summer.
Great to see you, Tony.
Ethan Lane is with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, Washington, D.C., and joins us on today's Agribusiness Report.
American agriculture creates millions of jobs, all the while feeding and clothing the world. But with many policymakers so removed from the farm, attacks on farm policy threaten our livelihood and quality of life in rural America. Our strength is our willingness to work together for the benefit of all. That's why business and farm leaders have formed the Southwest Council of Agribusiness, to defend the bedrock of our economy and our way of life. This is Larry Combest. The Southwest Council of Agribusiness is at southwest-council.com.
At Plains Cotton Cooperative Association, our mission is to ensure the long-term profitability of our grower owners through value-added marketing programs and through services to their gins. As a true cooperative, we pay dividends back to our grower owners to financially strengthen their farming operations, whether in Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, or New Mexico. Rest assured, at PCCA, we make money for you, not from you.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Agribusiness Report. Dr. Bart Fisher is co-director of the Agriculture Food Policy Center at Texas A&M, former chief economist at the House Ag Committee on the Inflation Reduction Act and conservation.
The Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, the so-called another show of hands. Anybody in the room think that spending $1.7 trillion is going to reduce inflation? Any takers? I didn't think so. Washington has a way of coming up with creative names for legislation. But the so-called Inflation Reduction Act was really a compromise in response to the Bipartisan Budget Act that the president had proposed. And it was a multi-trillion dollar bill. And so Senator Manchin, Senator Sinema, from Arizona, more or less held that up. They ended up reaching a compromise this past fall called the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA of 2022. Some of you don't see it in here. One of those provisions sandwiched in here is debt relief for socially disadvantaged growers. They had floated that earlier in the year. It got held up in the courts. Congress came back. They more or less used the money that was over here in this gray part and just repurposed it here so it doesn't show up again. But some of you may very well have already received notice in the mail that all of your FSA-held debt is being completely wiped out. And so that was a component of this. The more notable in terms of size was the one on conservation. And so it included almost $17 billion in plus up to conservation spending. You know, there's a lot of things where I'll poke at the administration, and admittedly I worked for Republicans for 8.5 years on the Hill. Now I'm in a nonpartisan, bipartisan, all of the above sort of role. But one thing I will say about the current administration and Congress that was controlled by Democrats is that with all the focus on climate, the approach they took was to plus up the existing programs. And so it could have been a lot worse, right? You know, cap and trade and all these other things that had been considered a decade earlier. And so I may poke some fun, but I'll give them some credit there that they stuck with, the programs that we know. The one problem with that, though, is instead of just increasing and leaving it at that, of course, we had to tie all sorts of new strings to it. And it's a one-time infusion.
It's the Agribusiness Report.
Supporting the High Plains cotton producer is the number one priority for Plains cotton growers. Since its inception in 1956, PCG has focused on being the advocate for High Plains cotton and a respected voice on cotton issues. Protecting the interest of the High Plains cotton producer requires a dependable, dedicated organization focused on getting results, and cotton producers depend on the organization they founded, Plains Cotton Growers. From the halls of Congress to the turn rows of the High Plains, cotton producers depend on Plains Cotton Growers.
Let's talk about logos. What's the value of a good mark? Well, when it comes to the seal of cotton, it's pretty big. Introduced in 1973, the seal of cotton trademark has planted itself in consumers' headspaces. In fact, 94% of consumers say the seal helps them easily identify cotton products. 85% say they associate the seal with softness, comfort, and durability. 40 years of cotton research and promotion really adds up. You grow the cotton? The Cotton Research Promotion Program helps grow the value. Learn more at cottonboard.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Agribusiness Report. Again, our special guest today, Ethan Lane, National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
Texas Corn Producers serves the state's corn farmers through both the Corn Board and the Association. The board is putting your checkoff dollars to work in research, promotion, and education to ensure producer profitability and market expansion. The member-supported association is the farmer's advocate in Austin and Washington, D.C. on issues from the Farm Bill, water and property rights, and more. Join the Texas Corn Producers Association today and get the latest news and information about Texas Corn Producers' efforts online at www.texascorn.org.
Where is the beef industry heading? Find out firsthand October 8th, 9th, and 10th at the Gaylord Texan Resort in Grapevine. It's Texas Cattle Feeders Association's annual convention featuring John Foley, a former Blue Angels pilot, and mentalist and illusionist Wayne Hoffman. The 2023 TCFA annual convention in Grapevine. Learn more online, tcfa.org. It's the Agribusiness Report.
Yes, it's true.
The weather has improved in the Midwest and the Great Plains.
But USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says, of course, that improvement came at the very tail end of a week of very severe heat.
And we saw corresponding decreases in most crop conditions.
For the corn crop, as we start this week,
55% of the U.S. corn rated good to excellent, 15% very poor to poor. A week ago, those numbers were at 57% and 13% respectively.
Worst state to be growing corn right now, Missouri. 44% of that crop rated poor to very poor. For the nation's soybean crop, also a heat-related condition decline. 52% of the soybeans rated good to excellent, 15% poor to very poor.
A two-point change for the worse in the good to excellent numbers from last week's 54% and a one-point increase from last week's 14% in the very poor to poor category.
Again, Missouri with beans in the worst shape, 34% poor to very poor. Gary Crawford, Washington.